I'm Tony Ryan in Adelaide, South Australia, and I'm in a Skype conversation today with Miles Groth, Professor of Psychology at Wagner College in New York. For the first edition of New Male Studies, an international journal, Dr. Groth has written an article entitled Meeting Men, Male Intimacy and College Men Centres. Miles, let's now return to the Wagner College model and the experience gained through the men's centre. How do men become involved in the centre in the first place?
An image of a wheel with spokes, an old image comes to mind. The initial group came together because they knew me. They were in my classes, they were my advisees, they were people whom I had met. So, connected to me, there they were, forming a circle. And then friends of theirs would join the circle. I didn't know them. The years that followed, we began to advertise in cafeteria and in the newspaper, in online sources, that there was such a center and that it would meet at a certain time. Everything is entirely done voluntarily. There are no requirements for membership. It's not a club, as a matter of fact. It's a study group. I like to think of it as a study group, although it's much, much more. But presented that way, that kind of neutrality seems to work. And so they bring friends. They tell their friends about it, word of mouth. And a guy will come, attend a meeting. He'll come back and back and back and back. Some come, don't come back. And the group then, from year to year, has identified one fellow who has some time to act as coordinator. And all that means is that he buys the food for the meeting. It's generally once a week, this semester on a Wednesday night for an hour and a half, 2 hours, they've gone longer. And they meet for talk, and with a few new elements added to each year. The program has gone from, I'd say, an exploration group of explorers about what such a group could be to a group that's taken on the lineaments of a certain kind of group. But it's entirely informal in the way it's arranged. I'm there in the background to provide some funding, to act as liaison with the college, provide them with place to meet on campus and, legitimize it. You have to do that on a college campus and look out for them as one might need to when on campus. So the group is evolving, and the form that it takes is evolving, and that's the case on all campuses.
I believe that an important part of the annual program is participation in a weekend retreat in the country somewhere, I believe. What do you see as the importance of that time out?
We have fortunately had enough money to sponsor a retreat for 8 to 10 of the guys each semester. So there are two of them each year, and it's only a Friday through Sunday arrangement. It's actually a converted barn that's rented out to lots and lots of groups up near Bard College, and I guess 100 miles north of the city. The retreat is important because it brings these guys away from the college atmosphere. It brings them together so that they have an opportunity to live with each other, cook, get to know each other informally, and being stuck together, depending upon each other, tends to evoke wonderful qualities that they may not have an opportunity to display back on campus, where they have to food shop for each other, look after each other's needs, try to keep each other comfortable. And, of course, as every one of them will tell you, it's just a nice time to unwind and relax and talk about anything that comes to mind. What I've tried to do, I've suggested this, and it's happened on a couple of the retreats, I've said, you can offer, and this coordinator, I've said, you can offer that each one be responsible for, say, an hour. And, okay, so the group will get together sometime with person X as the group leader for an hour. maybe he'll play the guitar for them. Another one may take them on a walk. It's in the woods, so take them on a walk and just wander about. Another will tell stories. Another will lead a discussion. So each person is at least offered the opportunity to take some kind of leadership. And some pass on it, others enjoy it. But overall, the experience has been very positive. Most of the guys have come back saying maybe more organization. That surprised me. Maybe more organization is in order. But I felt it was better to, at the beginning, let it be as organic and freeform as possible, and just provide a setting for intimacy and camaraderie.
Well, you've just raised the word intimacy, and that, to me, gets to the core of what you're saying. Many of our listeners might be quite comfortable with the idea of new friendships made through a men's centre on a university campus, but maybe they're not so comfortable with those words, male intimacy. How would you assure those listeners about the importance for young men of experiencing genuine intimacy with other males?
Well, Tony, this is the heart of the whole thing. And in the article that you mentioned, and in other places, I was there in Australia this past summer to talk about this in part and other matters. Boy, this is such a large question and central. Our culture has in 100 years, I'm at this point trying to do some research on this, and I'm finding some really fascinating material. But since World War I, and this was certainly true for the States, but also for everywhere in the world, where lots and lots of men were sent away from home to fight, the whole climate of relationships between men changed. The kind of intimacy that was standard in the 19th century, and it was powerful. If you read, stick with the literature that I know best. If you read Hawthorne and Melville, the great American novelists, and others, Thoreau, essayists, Emerson, you find that, and in archival literature, that close relationships with men were standard. That was just part of everyday life. And these were relationships outside the family, but in small towns, in cities. The men who went off to war found that they had these kinds of powerful, intimate relationships when they were at war. This happened again in the Second World War. This has been documented, by the way. And it happened in Korea, it happened in Vietnam, it's sad to say it continues to happen. But back home, men who had lost this kind of sense of intimacy with each other as the 20th century turned, and had seen it, for example, when they were away on the battlefield, returned home to find that there was nothing that their fathers had experienced for them to experience. So what I'm looking at is, I think, a historical trend. There's a story here that hasn't been told, that it's there in bits and pieces. But to cut to the chase, what I'm learning is that these young men crave that kind of relationship. They have their family close ties, if they're lucky. They have their girlfriends. They have relationships of a sexual kind with their girlfriends, but what the culture has not provided for them is the okay for close friendships. And I prefer to use that dangerous word intimacy because it makes people stop and as you indicated, what's he talking about here? What I'm talking about is a sense of closeness that is well known in most cultures, has been known in most cultures as long as we have records. However you explain it, and some explained it in terms of men hunting, in groups and having formed relationships of intimacy, quiet intimacy, not always very talkative kinds of intimacy, closeness. Lionel Tiger, of course, wrote about this famously in his book, Men in Groups, and Robin Fox has since followed him on that. And Lionel, whom I know, of course, has written about it even more recently in a book called The Decline of Males, in which he sees the problem of intimacy as central to changing times for men. On the positive side, what I think these groups provide is a confirmation that you can have this kind of close relationship. And I have to tell you, I went to school in the 60s, 64 to 68. I was an undergraduate. I happened to have gone to an all-men school that is now co-ed. And I can recall very clearly this kind of relationship. And I'm still in touch with three guys from those days. We talk maybe 2-3 times a year. But that was pretty standard, and not only just because it was a men's school, but I think it was the case in the culture at that time. We were probably the last generation to experience that. Now, that was not the case, I think, outside of college. So this makes it a very complicated story, because I think, for example, my father's generation, that was the World War II guys, were the first to miss it when they came back home. And they had had good friends in the service, but they didn't find that that was possible anymore. I think my father's generation was the first to experience this kind of loneliness. We who were in college, I think, were exceptional in that sense. And the ones who went into the service, it was a horrible place to have to experience that. But they had those kinds of relationships. Now, without that, for a lot of young men, so let's say three full generations of men, I think, have missed, with some exceptions, have missed these opportunities for a confident, supportive relationship with another man. The absence of sexual tension is a plus. The fact that there doesn't have to be a lot of talk is a plus. Men tend to be able to express and feel, experience intimacy without doing a lot of talking. Maybe they'll stand around and work on the hull of a little boat, or they'll take a walk out in the woods if they're going to go hunting, or they'll sit and fish, or they'll tinker with an engine or something like that. And there may not be a lot of talk, you know. And here I'm thinking, by the way, of your men's sheds in Australia, which seem to serve that so nicely. But the men need this, no doubt about it. And if I can add one more note, I think culturally this is so important, because it's become pretty clear that a wife or a spouse can't be all things to a man, you know. She can be a sexual partner, she can be a mother, she can be a spouse. But I think that there are some things that are provided by other men, by peers, and in the case of college men, sometimes by older men, by what I'm calling mentors, that no one else can provide. And that's necessary for feeling good about yourself as being a man.
But you do nonetheless describe this as delicate territory. And if I can give one example, I joined a group of men in Western Australia at one stage for a men's gathering, and one of my colleagues here in Adelaide simply said, "Oh yeah," with that kind of upward intonation, a little bit suspect, as it were. A pity, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Of course, there's the suspicion that it's a secret club, or there's a suspicion that it's somehow a gay group. It's a curious thing, and the guys have talked about it, by the way, and as these centers are forming, that issue comes up. It takes a while for it to come up, but the fact that there's some sort of subtext or backstory or something about these guys who join the groups is there. It's a reality. But surprisingly, I want to say this gives me heart. Surprisingly, it doesn't seem to be that much the case for the women, the young women on campus, and for the guys on campus once they find out what the group is really about, as it is a problem for the faculty and for the administration, who aren't able to imagine something other than that sort of old stereotyped puzzlement, you know, that surely this must be some secret society with some secret agenda attached to it, or some sexual agenda attached to it.
You're right that men of college age are in these men's centres reconsidering their boyhood, wondering what fatherhood might mean to them, and coming to terms with having a male body. What's the importance of this questioning by today's young men?
Well, we're in a period with a 50% divorce rate here in this country, and one out of three boys being raised by a single parent who will nearly always be a woman will be the mom. And so large number of males, young males, are growing up in a situation without a father. The missing father is, it seems to me, a very, very serious issue culturally that we haven't quite seen the results of yet. One of my favorite authors, the Italian psychologist Luigi Zoia, published a book called The Father some years ago now, and in it he talked about the experience of the necessary experience to a young male of having a father. And anything else that we might say about, well, it's, you know, there have been nuclear families as far as we can tell for thousands of years from burial mounds. We know that there have been such groups. From just a current psychological perspective, it's not clear to me that a boy can make the transition to manhood without a father. Boy, father, man. The connecting person there is the father. So these groups gravitate to discussions about, well, how was it when you were growing up as a boy? What was your boyhood like? And how was it with your dad? Well, I didn't have a dad. Oh. And what was that like for you? And then they hear from somebody who did have a dad. And given the statistics, those are fewer and fewer in number. They find these discussions keep returning. And particularly as they're thinking, you know, I want to maybe marry this girl that I'm dating now and be a father. What kind of a father will I be? I guess the last element that you mentioned is so important too, because manhood, being a male, is very much an embodied matter. It's about having a certain kind of body. And these guys, many of them who are raised in families without fathers, have, and I think this can be empirically verified, but many of them have problems with body image, problems with a sense of whether they're adequate as males as a result of having missed that link between boyhood and manhood, which is the father. I can tell you just a personal story. At some point, I wandered into the bathroom and wanted to take a shower with my father, and I was very lucky because he was just as cool about it as anything. And, you know, I guess I was 7 or 8 or, you know, climbed in there. And so we took a shower together and I got out of, he handed me a towel. He got out, he toweled off and we went our various ways. For some boys, that's not going to happen until they go to school and go to gym class, unless they have older brothers. I was an only child, so this was a particularly important thing. But I think you become comfortable about having a male body, and it's not a mystery, and it's something that you feel proud about, and if your father is as cool about it as mine was, it just seems as natural as it can be. So body image issues, I think, come up perhaps fairly often for a lot of these guys because they haven't been around the embodied man, you know? They haven't been around the male. And this is why we chosen, by the way, the journal you mentioned to call it New Male Studies and not just say men's studies, because it speaks to this issue in particular. So there are some really powerful themes, boyhood, fatherhood, manhood, and having a male body, all of which are on the minds of guys, I'll tell you. And I could tell you a number of examples of this phenomenon that they've told me as I've gotten to know them through the years.
This actually leads me very nicely to ask about the role of the mentor in a college men's centre, and particularly given what you've just said, that many young men these days have not had the benefit of a strong father-son relationship.
What I have found that I can do, and what I recommend to people who are forming groups on college campuses, to take this active mentoring role. What does it mean? I can't be their father. I am their teacher sometimes. Sometimes I'm not. I'm just known to be a faculty member on campus to them. But what I can do is, wherever I find them in my classes, and this, then the word gets around, you know, Groth is user-friendly. If you're a guy and you're not sure what you want to do with your major, or you're puzzling, you might want to stop by and talk to him, or he might want to advise you to talk to somebody else, or go to the men's group, join the men's group, and I do this quite often. But this role, I think, is absolutely essential, and the kind of reward that you get from doing it. And I have to say, I think there may be women on campus, faculty members on campus, administrators on campus who would like to do it, but I'm going to say right now, I don't think it's something that a woman can do. I think it's something that only a man can do. The rewards of it are immense. Just yesterday, so a very recent example, I had a student in class. I didn't know him very, very well, but he came to me. He got to know me in a class in psychopathology, and towards the end of the semester, 15 weeks, I found out he was a musician and so on, just little chats at the end. So he came to me and he said that the very last class of the exam, 2 days ago, he said, I can't get out of this music requirement. I play piano for money on Staten Island, but I can't get out of this class. And so I said, oh, have you tried this? Have you tried that? And in any case, I had an email exchange with him, and he wrote back to me after I had given him some names and suggestions, said, thanks for looking after me. That's what mentors do. Mm-hmm. They look after guys. They tend them. They don't tell them what to do. They look after them. And I like to think of it as making way when there's an obstacle, maybe helping clearing the way so that they can move forward. I think these are some of the essential components of mentoring, and it's very gratifying to get that kind of response. And so this guy says, thanks for looking after me. Have a good Christmas. I'll see you next spring. You know, that's a nice Christmas present for me.
How does a faculty member work as a mentor in a group which is meant to be and which is student-driven?
As I mentioned earlier, in our program, I have to provide legitimacy on campus for the group, and I do that. That's one of the things the mentor does. I raised money for the third and fourth years of the Men's Center. That's what a mentor does. But what I find myself saying again and again to people who ask me about forming such groups is, by all means, be sure that you let the guys themselves take the lead and set the agenda. You can provide very, very, very general sorts of features for the program, like retreat or a place to stay, or some ideas about what to do on a retreat, or some themes. I'll even give a list of topics that might come up or ideas. But if it's not in the hands of one really committed student, I think is not going to work. Otherwise, it will appear to be more a helping organization, which I think there's enough of. And instead, it's got to be I'm looking at these six guys at Gustavus Adolphus who are doing it for each other, and the 10 guys at Wagner who are doing this for each other. So, you know, Groth is in the background, and if there's an issue about money or some technicality, you know, advice is sought, it's ideas, you know, can be given. But it really has to be something that the guys are committed to for each other. And I think that's one of the things that they take away from these groups is that they're there for each other.
Miles, what's your hope for these young men and the young men to come in the next 10 or 20 years?
Well, at this point, I'm ambivalent about matters. So I'm going to say I am really concerned. And I think that college men are in a precarious position. And I don't want to minimize that at all. I'd love to be, you know, just as optimistic and happy and say, here we have these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 colleges, and there'll be 7 more next year, and then there'll be one on every college campus in 10 years. But I think the odds for that happening are rather low, and I'm very concerned. I'm concerned also for what's happening in Canada and in Australia and in the UK, because I know I've learned now that this is not something that's just a U.S. thing. I'm by nature a really optimistic person. On the other hand, I feel that the situation is precarious for guys in college. How will these men's centers counteract that? Well, if they are allowed, if they can find one person on campus to step forward and make it possible for these guys to talk and then maybe initially speak for them, advocate for them, I can do that. If college administrations will listen, if the culture as a large will listen, I don't know. I think that the college age man, though, is the crucial age group because of his age. It's between the teens and the older years. At that age, they're especially open to thinking about new things. It's the critical age, obviously, then for preparing for life and for work and for families and whatever one is going to do with his life. I wish I could say that in 25 years we won't graduate the last bachelor's degree to a male, and that every college campus will have a men's center, but I'm worried that that's not the case. Best I can do is try to spread this word and talk about the positive things there are about these guys. It's remarkable to me that we have forgotten all of the good things that young men can do and all of the good things that they are.
Maybe we need to come back to that idea of the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
For sure. And
I like it.
I do too. I do too. And they're very likable. I hope your listeners will have a chance to go and look at www.collegemenscenters.com and just take a look at the schools and most of all, take a look at the guys who are there and look at their faces and look and read about what they're doing.
Thank you very much. So I had the pleasure of meeting you in Adelaide in June 2011. And even though as we're speaking right now, you're in New York and I'm in Adelaide, today's conversation has also been a great pleasure. Thank you for joining me today. And may I just say best wishes to all the team on the launch of New Male Studies and International Journal.
Thank you, Tony. This has been great. I remember our talking before, and I was really looking forward to this. It's been wonderful talking to you.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with Miles Groth, PhD, Professor of Psychology at Wagner College, Staten Island, New York, about his article, Meeting Men, Male Intimacy and College Men's Centres. Dr. Groth's full article is published in New Male Studies, Volume 1, Issue 1, January 2012, and is available online, www.newmalestudies.com. That's newmalestudies.com. In Adelaide, South Australia, I'm Tony Ryan.